Good evening. For WBAI News in New York, I'm Linda Perry with some of the news for Wednesday, May 3rd, 2017. An unarmed missile capable of sending a nuclear bomb across the world was launched this morning from California, this amid rising tensions between the U.S. and North Korea. The test of the unarmed Minuteman III intercontinental ballistic missile took 10 months to plan. It was the latest aimed at checking the readiness and accuracy of a weapons system that forms part of the U.S. nuclear force. The U.S. has about 450 of the missiles. Each can travel about 8,000 miles. It was the second such launch in 7 days from the base in Central California on the coast between Los Angeles and San Francisco. Meanwhile, Donald Trump this week said it would be appropriate for him to meet with the North Korean leader. He told Bloomberg News, "If it would be appropriate for me to meet with him, I would be honored to do it."
Today, I'm pleased to welcome President Abbas to the White House for his first visit to Washington in quite a while.
During a joint statement today with Palestinian leader Mahmoud Abbas at the White House, Donald Trump says he'll do whatever is necessary to reach a Mideast peace agreement.
Almost 24 years ago, it was on these grounds that President Abbas stood with a courageous peacemaker, then Israeli Prime Minister Yitzhak Rabin. Here at the White House, President Abbas signed a Declaration of Principles, very important, which laid the foundation for peace between the Israelis and Palestinians. The President and Mr. President, you signed your name to the first Israeli-Palestinian peace agreement. You remember that well, right? And I want to support you in being the Palestinian leader who signs his name to the final and most important peace agreement that brings safety, stability, prosperity to both peoples and to the region. I'm committed to working with Israel and the Palestinians to reach an agreement, but any agreement cannot be imposed by the United States or by any other nation. The Palestinians and Israelis must work together to reach an agreement that allows both peoples to live, worship, and thrive and prosper in peace. And I will do whatever is necessary to facilitate the agreement, to mediate, to arbitrate, anything they'd like to do. But I would love to be a mediator or an arbitrator or a facilitator, and we will get this done.
In other news, Puerto Rico's governor announced a restructuring of a portion of the $73 billion debt through courts after negotiations with bondholders failed. This is the biggest bankruptcy-type filing in the history of the U.S. municipal debt market. Governor Ricardo Rossello said that a federal control board overseeing the island's finances agreed with his request late Tuesday to put certain debts before a court. He said, "We're going to protect our people." This action comes a day after several major creditors sued the U.S. territory and its governor over defaults on the island's $70 billion in bonds. New York City Council Speaker Melissa Mark Viverito, however, says faced with an unelected fiscal control board and a complicit governor who is seeking to destroy unions, workers' rights, and the public education system on the island, the people of Puerto Rico are confronting one of our gravest moments in recent history. She goes on to say, "Right now, Puerto Ricans need support and courageous leadership, yet the island's government continues to find ways to weaken the people. Let's not be fooled. Today's decision will not help the island." Puerto Rican officials triggered the bankruptcy-like process after declaring that they could not agree to the massive cuts in spending and new taxes demanded by investors. A fiscal plan for Puerto Rico sets aside $800 million a year for debt payments, a fraction of the $35 billion due in interest and payments over the next decade. A federal court judge will now be in charge of the restructuring. Bondholders cannot challenge Rossello's decision until 120 days from now. Turning to police killings, there have been 333 fatal police shootings so far in 2017. The youngest, 15-year-old Jordan Edwards, he was shot dead this weekend in Botch Springs, Texas. The officer who killed the black teen was fired. The family wants criminal charges filed against the officer. Edwards was a high school freshman. He was leaving a party with his two brothers and two others Saturday night. Police spotted their car leaving the party. They were investigating underage drinking. Officer Oliver opened fire as the teens were driving away, killing the 15-year-old. In Baton Rouge, Louisiana, where a 37-year-old black man, Alton Sterling, was killed by white officers, the Justice Department announced they will not bring charges against police for civil rights violations. Sterling was shot to death July 5, 2016. Two white officers pinned him to the pavement outside a Louisiana convenience store. This is where he had been selling CDs. The killing was captured on cell phone video and circulated widely online, sparking demonstrations across Baton Rouge. U.S. Attorney General Jeff Sessions, who said the administration of Barack Obama unfairly targeted police in civil rights investigations, has already ordered a review of federal agreements with police departments. But there is some justice for the family of Walter Scott. The 50-year-old black man was murdered by white police officer Michael Slager. Video was seen from that killing around the world. It shows Scott running from Slager, getting about 17 feet from him before the officer fired 8 times at his back. Scott then crumbles to the ground. 5 of the bullets hit his body. A plea formally entered Tuesday likely means Slager and his attorneys felt the federal government's case against him was strong. It came weeks after the judge ruled that the video would be allowed as evidence at trial. That video added fuel to the Black Lives Matter movement, and it was seized on by many as proof of what black Americans have argued for years, that white officers too often use deadly force unnecessarily against black people. Now it's up to the judge to decide the fate of that fired white officer who pleaded guilty. Michael Slager could get life in prison, or he could get as little as probation. And this is the news on listener-sponsored non-commercial Pacifica Radio, WBAI, in New York. FBI Director James Comey testified at a Senate Judiciary Committee oversight hearing today on his agency's operation. He said there were two ways to go regarding investigations into Hillary Clinton's emails 11 days before the presidential election, conceal or reveal. That to keep Congress in the dark would have been really bad or catastrophic. Here's Senator Dianne Feinstein questioning FBI Director James Comey.
Director, I have one question regarding my opening comment, and I view it as a most important question, and I hope you will answer it. Why was it necessary to announce 11 days before a presidential election that you were opening an investigation on a new computer without any knowledge of what was in that computer? Why didn't you just do the investigation as you would normally, with no public announcement?
Yeah, great question, Senator. Thank you. October 27th, the investigative team that had finished the investigation in July, focused on Secretary Clinton's emails, asked to meet with me. So I met with them that morning, late morning, in my conference room, and they laid out for me what they could see from the metadata on this fella Anthony Weiner's laptop that had been seized in an unrelated case. What they could see from the metadata was that there were thousands of Secretary Clinton's emails on that device, including what they thought might be the missing emails from her first 3 months as Secretary of State. We never found any emails from her first 3 months. She was using a Verizon BlackBerry then, and that's obviously very important. Yeah. Because if there was evidence that she was acting with bad intent, that's where it would be in the
but
first 3 months.
But they weren't there.
Look, can I just finish my answer, Senator?
Yeah.
And so they came in and said, we can see thousands of emails from the Clinton email domain, including many, many, many from the Verizon Clinton domain, BlackBerry domain. They said, we think we got to get a search warrant to go get these. And the Department of Justice agreed we had to go get a search warrant. So I agreed. I authorized them to seek a search warrant. And then I faced a choice. And I've lived my entire career by the tradition that if you can possibly avoid it, you avoid any action in the run-up to an election that might have an impact, whether it's a dog-catcher election or president of the United States. But I sat there that morning, and I could not see a door labeled no action here. I could see two doors, and they were both actions. One was labeled speak, the other was labeled conceal. Because here's how I thought about it. I'm not trying to talk you into this, but I want you to know my thinking. Having repeatedly told this Congress, we are done and there's nothing there, there's no case there, there's no case there, to restart in a hugely significant way, potentially finding the emails that would reflect on her intent from the beginning, and not speak about it would require an act of concealment, in my view. And so I stared at speak and conceal. Speak would be really bad. There's an election in 11 days. Lordy, that would be really bad. Concealing, in my view, would be catastrophic. Not just to the FBI, but well beyond. And honestly, as between really bad and catastrophic, I said to my team, we've got to walk into the world of really bad. I've got to tell Congress that we're restarting this, not in some frivolous way, in a hugely significant way. And the team also told me, we cannot finish this work before the election. And then they worked night after night after night, and they found thousands of new emails. They found classified information on Anthony Weiner. Somehow, her emails are being forwarded to Anthony Weiner, including classified information by her assistant, Huma Abedin. And so they found thousands of new emails and then called me the Saturday night before the election and said, thanks to the wizardry of our technology, we've only had to personally read 6,000. We think we can finish tomorrow morning, Sunday. And so I met with them. And they said, we found a lot of new stuff. We did not find anything that changes our view of her intent. So we're in the same place we were in July. It hasn't changed our view. And I asked them lots of questions. And I said, okay, if that's where you are, then I also have to tell Congress that we're done. Look, this was terrible. It makes me mildly nauseous to think that we might have had some impact on the election. But honestly, it wouldn't change the decision. Everybody who disagrees with me has to come back to October 28th with me and stare at this and tell me what you would do. Would you speak or would you conceal? And I could be wrong. But we honestly made a decision between those two choices that even in hindsight, and this has been one of the world's most painful experiences, I would make the same decision. I would not conceal that on October 28th from the Congress. And I sent a letter to Congress. By the way, people forget this. I didn't make a public announcement. I sent a private letter to the chairs and the rankings of the oversight committees. It's a distinction without a difference in the world of leaks, but it was very important that I tell them instead of concealing. And reasonable people can disagree, but that's the reason I made that choice. And it was a hard choice. I still believe in retrospect the right choice, as painful as this has been. And I'm sorry for the long answer.
Well, let me respond. On the letter, it was just a matter of minutes before the world knew about it. Secondly, my understanding, and staff has just said to me, that you didn't get a search warrant before making the announcement.
I think that's right. I think I authorized, and the Department of Justice agreed we were going to seek a search warrant. I actually don't see it as a meaningful distinction.
Well, it's very hard. It would have been, you took an enormous gamble. The gamble was that there was something there that would invalidate her candidacy, and there wasn't. So one has to look at that action and say, did it affect the campaign? And I think most people who have looked at this say, yes, it did affect the campaign. Why would he do it? And was there any conflict among your staff, people saying do it, people saying don't do it, as has been reported?
No, there was a great debate. I have a fabulous staff at all levels, and one of my junior lawyers said, should you consider that what you're about to do may help elect Donald Trump president? And I said, thank you for raising that, not for a moment, because down that path lies the death of the FBI as an independent institution in America. I can't consider for a second whose political fortunes will be affected in what way. We have to ask ourselves, what is the right thing to do? And then do that thing. I'm very proud of the way we debated it. And at the end of the day, everyone on my team agreed we have to tell Congress that we are restarting this in a hugely significant way.
Well, there's a way to do that. I don't know whether it would work or not, but certainly in a classified way, carrying out your tradition of not announcing investigations. And, yeah. I look at this exactly the opposite way you do. Everybody knew it would influence the investigation before, that there was a very large percentage of chance that it would. And yet that percentage of chance was taken, and there was no information, and the election was lost.
California Senator Dianne Feinstein questioning FBI Director James Comey. Then Senator Patrick Leahy from Vermont questioned the FBI director. He wants to know why the FBI didn't reveal an ongoing investigation into Trump and his associates, which began in July during the campaign. While the FBI did reveal that it reopened the Clinton investigation, Comey says it was because he testified under oath that the Clinton investigation was wrapped up, but had never commented publicly on the FBI's investigation into Trump's ties to Russia. Here's Senator Patrick Leahy.
Senator Feinstein noted that Americans across the country have been confused and disappointed by your judgment handling the investigation into Secretary Clinton's emails. On a number of occasions, you chose to comment directly and extensively on that investigation. You even released internal FBI memos and interview notes. I may have missed this, but my 42 years here, I've never seen anything like that. But you said absolutely nothing regarding the investigation into the Trump campaign's connections to Russia's illegal efforts to help elect Donald Trump. Was it appropriate for you to comment on one investigation repeatedly and not say anything about the other?
I think so. Can I explain, Senator?
I only have so much time.
Okay, I'll be quick. The department, I think I treated both investigations consistently under the same principles. People forget, we would not conduct Hillary Clinton email investigation until 3 months after it began, even though it began with a public referral and the candidate herself talked about it. In October of 2015, we confirmed it existed and then said not another word, not a peep about
until,
it until we were finished.
The most critical time possible, a couple weeks before the election. And I think there are other things involved in that election, I'll grant that. But there's no question that had a great effect. Historians can debate what kind of an effect it was. But you did do it. In October, the FBI was investigating the Trump campaign's connection to Russia. You sent a letter informing the Senate and House that you were reviewing additional emails that could be relevant to this, but both investigations were open, but you still only commented on one.
I commented, as I explained earlier, on October 28th in a letter that I sent to the chair and rankings of the oversight committees that we were taking additional steps in the Clinton email investigation because I had testified under oath repeatedly that we were done, that we were finished there. With respect to the Russia investigation, we treated it like we did with the Clinton investigation. We didn't say a word about it until months into it, and then the only thing we've confirmed so far about this is same thing with the Clinton investigation, that we are investigating. And I would expect we're not going to say another peep about it until we're done. And I don't know what will be said when we're done, but that's the way we handled the Clinton investigation.
Vermont Senator Patrick Leahy questioning FBI Director James Comey at a Senate Judiciary hearing today. The FBI Director's decisions of last summer and last fall continue to produce lingering second-guessing about whether the investigations were handled evenly. And you're listening to the news on WBAI in New York. Tomorrow, Donald Trump is expected to return to New York City. He was last seen here back on January 19th. On Thursday, Trump will mark the anniversary of a World War II battle at the Intrepid on the Hudson River, the 75th anniversary of the Battle of the Coral Sea, in which American and Australian forces stopped a strategic advance by the Japanese military. But this is New York, and Trump will be greeted by protests which began before he was inaugurated, protests which continue each week here in New York City. Tomorrow, the Immigration Coalition says the world will see us rise up and oppose Donald Trump once again.
And there's a reason why Donald Trump can whip up fascist thugs under the watchwords of Make America Great Again. Because everybody knows that means a return to open white supremacist terror, demonization of other people who are not white Christian men. Because this country was never great and it needs to be gotten rid of through a revolution. And the Revolution Club is organizing, and it's time to get organized for an actual revolution.
On May Day, Noche Diaz with the Revolution Club said, with more than 100 days of Donald Trump in office, people have been out in the hundreds and millions opposing everything that he represents.
But it's actually not enough to just resist every attack that he unleashes on people. We need to go from responding to every crime he commits to a movement where people are aiming to drive him out so that we do not have to be Anne Franking our way through the next 4 years and trying to hide people from the attacks that he is unleashing against immigrants. That's why we're here today on May 1st, because a big part of their program has been demonizing and scapegoating immigrant people. Jeff Sessions has talked about Mexicans the way Hitler talked about the Jews, and they're priming people up to go along with genocidal program. And we're here to unite with everybody who came out today to say no to this whole fascist program, and we need to drive them out. And we're letting people know that this country was never great. This has been the homeland of terror, the homeland of slavery, the homeland of chemical warfare and using nuclear bombs on people all over the world. This system that produced Donald Trump needs to be gotten rid of, and that's what the Revolution Club is out here doing, and that's what people need to hear on May 1st. This is a revolutionary holiday. We're wishing people a revolutionary May 1st, where we celebrate the struggle against this whole system and for a whole nother world.
You know, I have a real problem with the mainstream media. On one hand, it's normalizing Donald
That's
Trump,
right.
And on the other hand, it is criticizing him when he is trying to talk to some, supposedly to speak with other leaders of other countries. So there's, you're getting mixed messages from the mainstream press.
Right. Look, I mean, they're opposite. It's a real problem. Look, there's a lot of people who are opposed to Trump because he's attacking the traditional forms of what terror this country has committed against people around the world. So they criticize him from a framework that will not get people actually moving to oppose this regime, and they're trying to confine the resistance of people onto terms that might round out the rough edges but keep things on a trajectory of normalization. And this is a very dangerous thing. I mean, when he launched those missiles into Syria, they said all of a sudden he earned the presidency. Come on. Okay? When he dropped the mother of all bombs, people had already heard from the media that, oh, he's acting presidential now. He has earned the seat of the White House. And the people did not come out and respond the way they needed to say no to that and to oppose that and reject that. It's not good, okay? And that there are not more people out today when the situation is so serious and so dire, okay? And not just immigrant people, too. Because if just the people under the gun come out to oppose that, they're going to be the targets and they're going to be more easily rounded up. Everybody needs to be coming out and saying no and standing together to drive this thing out. And yes, it's not going to come from the people who have been normalizing him from day one. And they're following too many leaders of the Democratic Party who have come out. You know, Obama is normalizer in chief when he said we and Trump are on the same team. If Trump wins, we all win. No, if Trump wins, humanity loses, okay? We don't need to work with fascism. That's how you normalize the road to crimes against humanity.
Revolutionary fighter with the Revolution Club, Noche Diaz. And as Donald Trump passed the 100-day mark in office, women rallied to send the message that Donald Trump fails women. Now, New York issued a women's rights report card. They say it's not a newsflash that Trump fails women. Dominique Jack reports.
Under the bright blue skies of a warm spring day, women in white were marching around Central Park, holding up signs with big red Fs. Sonia Osorio led a passionate group of chanting women from Columbus Circle all the way up to Grand Army Plaza. She's the president of the National Organization for Women of New York, or NOW for short.
We marched 100 days ago because we were scared of what the Trump presidency would mean for women, for families, for our country, for democracy. And women's rights are really, you know, under attack. These are very, very serious times. So we have thought a lot about the women who came before us, who fought for our right to vote and all that they went through, and they persisted year in and year out against incredible odds. They persisted, and they, you know, the pictures, they're wearing white when they're in front of the White House protesting, and so it's just kind of a nod to them.
The women of NOW say Trump gets an F for his first 100 days in office. Their report card highlights his failures in protecting women's health care and ensuring protections from violence and sexual harassment. Women protested Trump's plans to defund protective services, revoke the Fair Pay and Safe Workplace Order, and revive the gag rule. They also spoke against Trump defending Bill O'Reilly, saying that it contributes to unsafe workplace cultures for women.
And for women's rights, we're now finally at the point where we very well may see Roe v. Wade rolled back, where at the very same time that there's efforts to curtail abortion rights and defund reproductive rights care, there's also a effort to roll back our access to birth control. It really feels like the type of issues that our foremothers had to fight for, not even in the 70s, but before that. We work with women every day who face discrimination in the workplace. We know how epidemic it is. We know how much it goes unresolved and how few resources exist for women to be able to rectify the situation. So it's truly a tragedy for women.
Rally-goers say they worry for the future of women's rights under Trump's administration. Vanessa Aronson, running for New York City Council, says it's important to protest against Trump's plans.
He's sending a message that women do not matter in his America, that we're second-class citizens, that unless you're a white, wealthy man from a city, that you know, in that case, you can do whatever you want. Like he said, when you're rich and famous, you can get away with anything. And he's sending the message that the America that he's building is not for everyone. People are stepping up, that we're not just taking this lying down. We're no longer gonna be the silent majority. Women are stepping up, and we're gonna demand a seat at the decision-making table.
The National Organization for Women continues to hold rallies around New York and across the country. More information on their future events can be found on their website, now.org. Dominique Jack, WBAI News, New York.
And that's the WBAI Evening News for Wednesday, May 3rd, 2017. The news was produced with Dominique Jack and Reggie Johnson. Linda Perry, WBAI News, New York.